And now to brief introductions. We are joined by Dr. Alex Schaefer. He is a practicing internal medicine physician here at Providence St. Vincent. He did his med school at UCLA and residency at University of Washington. Dr. Schaefer is a clinician educator with our internal medicine residency here at Providence St. Vincent. He's particularly passionate and skilled at teaching about clinical reasoning and patient communication. He carries many leadership roles and has been particularly active with American College of Physicians and is governor-elect for Oregon ACP. Dr. Schaefer has a really fun and informative talk here for us today, so let's get to it.
Thank you to all the obligate participants today from my colleagues. I appreciate that. And to both residents who showed up today, even though their chief resident is away getting married, I really sort of appreciate that. So who, raise your hands if you've not done a thieves market before, if you've not seen a thieves market. Okay, a couple of people. So I can go through the instructions pretty quickly. You should have a clicker. If you don't have one of these white ones, please get one at the side, because we're really gonna need your participation before or as we go through this today. So here are our learning objectives. You're going to find out how does your clinical reasoning on interesting and unusual cases compare with that of other internists? Can internal medicine really be this much fun? And will I achieve instant fame and fortune by correctly diagnosing a case before it is presented on the screen? So, I want to give some gratitude to my mentor in all of this, Dr. David Scrace at the University of New Mexico, who's been doing these presentations for some 30 years at the National ACP and many other places, and also from case contributors from here in Oregon in the Pacific Northwest. You may recognize some of these faces here going back. So here's how these cases work. We've got three of them today. I'm going to present three cases. There's going to be a presentation of the history, the key exam findings, the basic lab, key diagnostic test, and at the end, a summary of the diagnostic entity. Yes, it sounds a little bit like any old boring morning report that we might do. Not that our morning reports are ever boring here at St. Vincent's, but this one's a little bit different because here's my role. I'm not going to lie to you if you ask me a direct question. I'm not always going to report all of the facts right at the very beginning. Patients don't always report all of the facts right at the very beginning. I'm not going to withhold information when asked a direct question. I'm going to have fun no matter what the rest of you do today, but I'm going to give winners $1 million. I've got them right here. So you want to be able to win and walk away with the $1 million. Your role is you're the thieves. That's why this is called Thieves Market. You're going to try to steal the diagnosis by yelling it out loud. You're going to interrupt me whenever you think you know what's going on and yell so that I can hear what you think the diagnosis is. And if you're the first one to shout out the exact diagnosis, then you win. I promise not to ridicule any of your guesses unless they're ridiculous. And the requirements to win are that you must say, and I must acknowledge the diagnosis. I'm not going to confirm that you're correct until the end so that other people can keep playing, the other people who are not as smart as you. And I really kind of insist that you have fun today. That's what the clickers are for. Here's some pictures of winners in the past. On the left, we have people from the Pacific Northwest and our local Oregon, et cetera, who've won going way back here. And on the right, just some of the pictures of national winners at the National ACP. Do you know this case? It's possible. I do my best to present cases I haven't presented in this setting before. This is the same presentation I gave at the Oregon ACP a few months ago. So if you were there, you know, it doesn't always work. If you know, realize you know what this case is, then you have some choices to make. If I were you, I'd just go for it. I would, yeah, shout out the diagnosis anyway, win the $1 million, and the decades of guilt that you suffer won't really affect my fun at all today if that's what you do. I just want to remind you the $1 million is not real, but anyway, so there are some tips here for using our audience response system. You need one of these clickers. Yours should be white, and you need to turn on the bottom button so that there's a blue light so that it is on. Make sure that you do that. You can only vote once. Your answers are going to be completely anonymous, and if you get the wrong answer, nobody will know. So try to decide very quickly, because you're only going to have about 10 seconds or so. Like, try to pretend you're the 49ers trying to figure out if you should get first possession in overtime. Okay, my brother said that joke would be funny, and it's the only sports joke that you're ever going to hear up here. Okay, so I have to say, I'm sorry about the people who are listening at home. We don't have a system for me to record your votes, so that's the bad news. But there's some really good news, because you can use any clicker in your house that you can find. You can vote as many times as you want, and the answers are even more anonymous. There we go. So let's do a little humor test. I'm going to go ahead and start the poll here. I'm going to turn on my clicker. I'm going to start the poll and go ahead and vote. Here's a cartoon. It's got death at the door. It says it ruins the effect if I say who it is. Can you just please come down? So go ahead and vote A, B, C, D, E. Do you think this is not funny, only slightly amusing, funny, really funny, or hysterically funny? Yeah, so I'm going to close the poll and let's see what people get here. If I display it, there it is. Okay, so, oh, good. We have a pretty good audience here. People think it's funny. We're on the right track here. We have a couple of people who are not really amused at all. And, it would be okay if you went back to doing whatever you're doing on your phone. You could be looking at Super Tuesday results or something, because it's really only going to go downhill from there. So let me make that go away and we'll move on. We have three cases. Here they are. A 21-year-old woman with severe abdominal pain is our first case. Then a 67-year-old woman worried about a spot. And then a 74-year-old woman with refractory oral ulcers, sprue, and a rash. Pick up a clicker if you're just coming in. Please do. You need to have a clicker to be here today, right by the door. So let's go on to our first case. Appendicitis. There you go. Yes. Yes, we have our program director guessing, aiming low. That's good. It's like going to a kind of a bad restaurant. You just order the burger and not the vichyssoise. So that's a appropriate thing to do. So this is our woman. She has she's previously healthy. She's 23. She presented to the hospital with intense abdominal pain, nausea, bilious non-bloody vomiting for 6 days. She was unable to tolerate oral intake, and she had been constipated for about 5 days. She denied hematemesis, hematochezia, melena, or hemoptysis. But she developed burgundy-colored urine 5 days before all this. She denied dysuria, flank pain, or vaginal discharge. She didn't have fevers, chills, oral ulcers, hair loss, headache, edema, rash, or petechiae. She has porphyria. There we go. That's a good guess. This morning, she developed some pain in her ankles. She denies unusual food exploration, recent travel, eating expired food, sick contacts, other friends or family members with similar symptoms. She's not had intense physical activity or participation in contact sports. Reiter's syndrome, okay, reactive arthritis. So past, here's some social history. She's a first-year law student, recently under some stress. She doesn't use tobacco or recreational drugs except alcohol, 3 to 4 shots of liquor per week. She's sexually active with one woman. She's in a monogamous relationship. Her mother had lupus. She has no previous surgeries, takes no medications. Here's her exam. Blood pressure's normal. Heart rate's 119, respiration's 18. Temperature, BMI, normal. Her head and neck, lung, heart exam, all unremarkable except for some tachycardia. Her belly, though, is distended. It's diffusely tender, especially in the right lower quadrant. She's got no guarding but a positive rebound, no palpable mass, no hepatosplenomegaly, and she has decreased breast sounds. Her extremities are unremarkable. There's no rash, no petechiae, no edema. Her neurologic exam is unremarkable. So let's go ahead and take a vote here again. What would you do? Would you check a urinalysis and a kidney function? Would you obtain abdominal x-rays and a CT scan? Check a CBC, haptoglobin, LDH? Would you provide reassurance and discharge her with a bowel regimen? Or would you order the additional special tests reserved for patients who are lawyers? That's the questions. Let's go ahead and take a guess here. We've got some votes coming in. Another minute or two here to decide that. Okay, let's see what do people think. Yeah, so people like the idea of the x-ray and the CT scan, check a urinalysis, and it looks like zero choices for E. That's good. Okay, I think that's appropriate. make this go away here. So here are some lab tests you get. She had a white count of 24,000. Platelets are normal, hemoglobin's normal, electrolytes are normal. Her creatinine's 0.99, her baseline was 0.7. You can make of that what you want. But a urinalysis does have 3+ blood with a bunch of red blood cells, red cell and granular casts. She has 2 to 3 casts per high power field. Urine protein to creatinine ratio is normal. Her albumin is 2.9. So her laboratory studies are the following. There's a creatinine kinase that's normal, a cholesterol that's normal. Her CRP is elevated, but the SED rate is not. She had a bunch of antibodies that came back in the first day or two. Negative hepatitis C, hepatitis B surface antigen, and IgM. Say that again. IgA vasculitis with nephropathy. Okay, there's a guess there. She has a negative ANCA, an ANA, a C3, C4, anti-GBM IgG, anti-Smith, and an RNP antibody. Her proton's a little elevated at 16.1, but her PTT is just above the normal range. Here's some x-rays. Give you a chance to take a peek at those. Obviously, she'd had some contrast on that before that belly film. And then let's go ahead and look at her CT scan here. There are some helpful arrows there. And to move this along, I'm going to tell you that those arrows are thought to reflect jejunal wall thickening and also demonstrated some mesangial edema. So what would you do? Let's go ahead and take another vote here. I would order an LDH, haptoglobin, and reticulocyte count. I would do upper and lower endoscopy with biopsy. Would you obtain a kidney biopsy? Would you start steroids? Or would you start steroids and activate the 24-hour stool collection for lawyers order set? Let's see here. What do people say? We'll give you a little more time to vote. All right, let's see. What are you interested in? All right, people like the idea of the upper and lower endoscopy. Okay, a few people going for a kidney biopsy right away here. And good, and nobody's ordering the collection for lawyers order set because I don't know if you were, that's good, because if you ordered the 24-hour stool collect for lawyers in order to give them special care or to harass them, either one of those would probably be illegal and immoral, so that's fine that you're not doing that. Let's see here, what do people want to do? So let's do another poll. I think that the two most unusual aspects of this case are which of the following. Sometimes it's helpful when you're not sure what's going on to look at the two things that stick out. So I'm going to ask you, what do you guys think are the two most unusual aspects? Glomerulonephritis and a negative autoimmune workup, the glomerulonephritis and the severe abdominal pain, the new onset glomerulonephritis and her age, burgundy urine and a normal creatinine kinase, or Alex making fun of lawyers, though married to one. See, what do people want to vote here? And it's not too late, of course, to have guesses. We're kind of all over the place there, but the most unusual thing, okay, is people actually are going for my making fun of lawyers. All right, the rest of these don't really impress you. HSP, okay. Yeah, you're thinking that's different than what she said. Yeah, well, I don't know, okay. Well, let's go. Yeah. So let's see here if we can move on with our case. There we go. Aha. So sometimes it's helpful just to review, you know, if you have an unusual diagnosis, review rare causes of abdominal pain and the extensive workup is negative. So I've got a few slides. Maybe this will be a little bit educational for us here. Think about mesenteric venous thrombosis. By the way, just because I put it up here doesn't mean it's not the diagnosis. It just means that if you haven't guessed it yet, that you can't win. Okay, so one of these might be the diagnosis. Mesenteric venous thrombosis presents as indolent abdominal pain, not explained by physical findings. It's often caused by hypercoagulable states, but you can also see it in pancreatitis, abdominal surgeries, and myeloproliferative disorders. You treat it with anticoagulation and sometimes thrombectomy or surgery. Another rare cause of abdominal pain when the workup is negative is paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. It's very rare. This is a PIGA gene mutation, which causes a complete absence or a partial complete absence of these proteins. And it presents with abdominal pain and microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. You make the diagnosis by testing for these proteins, and we don't use the old test so much anymore, this osmotic fragility test. It's a rare disease. You treat it with anticoagulation, sometimes with bone marrow transplantation when it's quite severe. Another cause someone mentioned at the very beginning was, someone said porphyria. They didn't specify which one, but acute intermittent porphyria is a possible diagnosis. Presents with neurovisceral symptoms, abdominal pain, psychiatric disturbances, or sometimes you're just the king of England. It's caused by partial deficiency of porphobilinogen, deaminase, precipitated often by menstruation, fasting, tobacco, infections, barbiturates, and other P450 inducers. The diagnosis is made with a 24-hour urine porphyrin and precursors, and you treat it supportively or sometimes with intravenous heme preparations. Another one to consider is familial Mediterranean fever, FMF. Think of this diagnosis when you have someone who has recurrent fever and abdominal pain. We certainly see things like that really often, but if you see that with cirrhosis, then FMF should come up your list. And it can be associated with secondary amyloidosis. The diagnosis is really clinical, although we know a few of the gene mutations, so sometimes we can make the diagnosis that way. So a diagnostic test was performed in this case. Go ahead and take a vote here. What do you think it was? Do you think it was an MR enterography, a kidney biopsy, exploratory lap, cystoscopy with retrograde ureteroscopy, or much to everyone's surprise, the 24-hour urine stool collection, which I think nobody voted for, so I guess it can't really be that. What do people guess here? Let's see on this. Yeah, so people think it was in fact a kidney biopsy. Some people are going for the MR, and one person thought an exploratory lap might be helpful here. There are more guesses. So does anyone have any last guesses about the diagnosis? You want to venture some more here? Grab some clickers, you guys. There should be clickers up there. Come on in. Any last guesses or make a guess about who this person is? Either one. Guesses. All right. This is Oprah Winfrey. Yeah. So here's the thing about this case. The H&E stain, there was a kidney biopsy. That was the diagnosis and the diagnostic test, I should say. And it showed mesangial hypercellularity. The trichome stain showed mild focal interstitial fibrosis. You can kind of see in there. The IgA immunofluorescence showed 2+ granular mesangial deposits in the glomerulus. And by the way, you'll remember on the CT scan, they saw mesangial enhancement or thickening, I think they said, mesangial enhancement. And on EM, sure enough, there were electron dense deposits in the mesangium. So the diagnosis was, in fact, IgA vasculitis. So I'm happy to say we have a winner here. We're going to come up and get your picture here in just a second, Laura. Let's talk about IgA vasculitis. Some of you may know it as Henoch-Schönlein purpura. Thank you very much, Emily, but you didn't win. You would have. It's also some other remote names are anaphylactoid purpura and purpura rheumatica. This is a disease that more commonly affects kids. It's often preceded by a throat infection. Laura, why don't you come up and get your $1 million? I'm going to get a picture of you. Come on up. Here we go. No, it was not fixed at all. I need your picture in front of the slide right over here. Yeah, that's perfect. Exactly. There we go. All right. Sorry to the home audience. We were just getting a picture there. Congratulations. So let's learn a little bit about Henoch and Schönlein. Here they are, these two old white guys who are also dead. And they became famous for this. Interestingly enough, Dr. Henoch was Dr. Schönlein's medical student. He first identified gastrointestinal and renal involvement of this disease a long time ago, 1868. He was the nephew of Romberg. Yes, that Romberg. And Schönlein, even older, was identified the association of joint pain and purpura in 1837. He was the physician to Frederick William IV. He also discovered honeycomb ringworm or favus, the parasite that causes that. But we don't like to use eponyms anymore. They're really not useful. So I just think of these old guys. I think of one of them as IgA and the other one is vasculitis. That's the new name for this. So whenever you see these faces, just think IgA and vasculitis. So what are the signs and symptoms of this disease? There's this nearly pathognomonic triad of purpura 100% of the time, joint pain, arthritis, and abdominal pain. That's the triad. And then a plurality of people have, just over a majority, have kidney disease, but not all of them. When they have kidney disease, there's always hematuria, sometimes proteinuria, and sometimes chronic kidney disease. The pathophysiology, it's a small vessel vasculitis. There's IgA and C3 complexes. Don't get confused between IgA vasculitis and IgA nephropathy, except to the extent that you should. Both of them have elevated IgA levels. The renal biopsies are identical. But IgA vasculitis, what you think of as HSP, is this more acute disease typically in children, more of a systemic disease. Whereas IgA nephropathy presents less systemic, pretty much limited to the kidneys, typically occurring in young adults. The diagnosis is based primarily on symptoms. Lab abnormalities include renal function, elevated IgA in about half of people, elevated inflammatory markers. The platelets are elevated, and that should stick out for you because unlike other purpuras, most other purpuras, the platelets here are elevated. In ITP and TTP, they tend to be low. And of course, skin biopsy can be diagnostic. Here's a picture of IgA deposits in the walls of small superficial capillaries. The treatment is interesting. Often these patients can be treated as an outpatient. Seems like one of these big entree serious internal medicine diseases, but analgesics or steroids for pain is often all that is needed. Sometimes the patients with kidney disease get steroids or immunosuppressants. There's very little data, however, to guide treatment, honestly. The prognosis is really pretty good for IgA vasculitis. There's recovery in 94% of kids and 89% of adults, respectively. Under age 10, though, the condition recurs at least a third of the time, usually in the first 4 months or so. Recurrence is even more common in older children and adults. These two guys on the right are actually also even deader and older, and they actually were the first to describe this, even though they didn't get famous for it. It didn't get named after them. Another reason eponyms are weight. So wait a minute. Some of you may wonder, let's go ahead and take a vote here. My slide said that 100% of patients have purpura, but this patient didn't have purpura. So what are you feeling? Are you going to take a vote? Are you feeling outraged? Are you feeling betrayed by the presenter? Are you feeling highly doubtful that this is really IgA vasculitis? Are you feeling that anyone below the age of 40 sort of should qualify as pediatric in your practice anyway because we're internists? Or should we eliminate all eponyms, but especially those with umlauts? Let's see, what do people say here? Go ahead and take a vote. Okay, a little bit betrayed. All right, well, hang in there. Some people are against umlauts. All right. Well, maybe we should learn a little bit more about umlauts. Facts you should know. The word umlaut comes from one of the brothers Grimm, from Jacob to be specific. Not all umlauts are umlauts. The mark that separates two adjacent vowels is called a diuresis or a trema. You see it in the French, Naive, Chloe, Noel, etc. And in the pages of the New Yorker, because that's the way they roll. You can see any pre-existing conditions over here. Yeah, this long word here is the Finnish word with the most umlauts in any language. I've never been to Finland. It translates as this sort of rhetorical question, not even with its unsystematized nature. That's the way it translates. And in Germany, the Big Mac was originally the Big Mac, but not anymore. And I don't really know why. So follow-up. After 4 days of IV methylprednisolone, our patient, the abdominal pain, petechiae, and ankle arthritis resolved. She then took prednisone 60 milligrams daily for 2 months. I got this slide a little out of order because it was really only after the switch to oral prednisone that she developed palpable petechiae and bilateral ankle arthritis. So it counts. This is one of these cases where 100% of people with IgA vasculitis have palpable petechiae. It's just not always when. But at 5 months, she was symptom free, though she had some proteinuria that had resolved. So let's go ahead and take another vote here. Now that you know the patient did have the purpuric rash, you're feeling only mildly sorry that you doubted me. Still skeptical that this is actually IgA vasculitis. And by the way, you don't believe in renal biopsies. That you should lower the cutoff in pediatrics in your practice to 30. That your diagnostic reasoning in this case was uber naive. Or you feel so guilty for falsely accusing me that you're going to present that Thieves Market case to me so that we can write it up for next year, which is the answer I really want everyone to answer. Let's see, what do people say? All right, unfortunately, we only have one person who has a case for me. Okay, well, what can we do? All right, well, I'm so happy that we had a winner. That's the best thing that can happen in Thieves Market. Let's see, well, I guess that explains the abdominal pains. That's another rare cause of severe abdominal pain, is the porcupine in the belly. Let's go on to our second case. Maybe a little bit briefer case here. This is a 67-year-old woman who is worried about a spot. So any of you can be winners. All of you came in late. I just want to remind you to turn on the blue light on your clickers and please vote when the time is appropriate, or other times if you want. It kind of goes into the cloud, so you can vote as many times as you want out there. So we have a patient who is concerned about a spot on her left leg that has recently changed. Quote, it was the same for 10 years. It was this light brown ring that I could feel, but for 2 months now, it looks different. It's red now. So time to be guessing, you never know. Granuloma annulare, okay. She has no pruritus, burning, pain, or any other symptoms. She denies any possibility of trauma, even unconscious scratching. It doesn't itch or bother me at all, so why would I scratch it, she said. She feels well. She emphasizes that her neighbor was recently diagnosed with skin cancer. Okay, so now we have the diagnosis, right? We all know what it is. Everyone knows that the patient is suffering from availability bias, right? My neighbor has skin cancer, so I must have skin cancer. You know, raise your hands if you have seen this before. I can even see in my brain here that some of the people at home are raising their hands because they've seen this before. So thank you for that. So I wondered what the ICD-10 code for availability bias was. And so I searched for that. And it turns out that all that comes up is acanthamoebiasis and amoebiasis. And then there is an ICD-10 code for the unavailability of internet or telephone service, but that's all you get. In other words, you're not allowed to diagnose your patients with availability bias. Only doctors get that diagnosis. So we have to move on. So let's go ahead and take a vote here. What do you think you're pretty sure about? Are you pretty sure that this is skin cancer, that this is self-induced, that this is ringworm, that this is some kind of annular skin lesion, or that you always mix up annular, angular, and annual skin lesions and that you need a refresher of those categories? Let's see what people have to say here. All right, we have a lot of people pretty confirmed that it's what I told them it was, and a few people who would like some mansplaining. Okay, so let's look at our past medical history here. Chronic pain, she has a cognitive communication disorder, not otherwise specified. She has mild familial neuropathy of some sort, obstructive sleep apnea, and TMJ syndrome. She takes meloxicam, and social history is not evaluated in this case because this is an ambulatory visit and all she had was a skin spot. I mean, come on. Charcot-Marie tooth, okay. Other diagnoses here, other guesses. So what are you most interested? Let's go ahead and take a vote again. What are you most interested in further information about? Other symptoms? Internists always want more information, particularly before they blurt out a guess. But that's not the way you win here. Other symptoms, other spots, the family history of skin diseases. Do you want to know about the neighbor's diagnosis? Do you want to know the neighbor's diagnosis and the genetic testing to see if they're twins secretly separated at birth, or perhaps they unknowingly share a patient? Which I see all the time on that Finding Your Roots television show, by the way, which is really cool. So let's see what people vote about, what our votes are. Hello. Batteries, it doesn't want to display. I don't know why, maybe I can do it this way. Oh yeah, I can do it that way. There we go. Other symptoms and other spots and the skin diseases. No one is taking the patient's clue about the rest of it. I can hide this there. Okay, so here's a picture of the skin lesion. Now you get to look at it, which is what you wanted from the very beginning. I'll let you look at it and I'll blab on. You know, you ever have a patient comes in and say, well, I've got this spot on my back, and they give you a 30-minute story about it. You just really want to look at the spot because you know you could probably don't need the whole story. Sometimes that's the case. And then when you don't know, then you have to go back and ask them all these questions about it. So let's go ahead. There's the spot. Any guesses? yeses. So let's go ahead and start and tell me at this point, what would you do? I would reassure the patient that you know exactly what it is and that there's no need to worry. You would reassure the patient that you have no idea what it is and still there's no need to worry. Have you, raise your hands if you've done that. Okay, yeah. Do a skin biopsy, just being honest, right? Do a skin biopsy. Would you refer the patient to dermatology or would you ask the patient if she thinks her secret neighbor could be scratching the lesion without her knowledge? After all, it has changed. She says she's not doing that. Let's go ahead and display our results here. Refer to dermatology. Okay. We have a few people who would do a skin biopsy. Oh, it moved. Hang on. I can put it back here. This is just interesting today. There it goes. Okay. So we displayed the results. Oh, it's still coming over there. Well, we'll make it work here somehow. And then my pointer will go over there. Well, we might have to do, I might have to just tell you how you're voting as we go along here. So let's review the a differential diagnosis of annular skin lesions. I promised you a little bit of that. It's a long list. So I'm just going to go through some of the common ones just to get you thinking. So tinea corporis, right? Well demarcated erythematous plaques with raised scaly borders. There's pityriasis rosea. It gives you these bursts, these sort of eruptions of fawn-colored patches with fine scale along the border. Granuloma annulari, as someone mentioned. Annular skin lesion, it's a plaque with kind of these waxy, non-scaly erythematous borders. Turns out there's a generalized form of that. I had a patient with not so long ago. Leprosy can do this, rare disease, but it can cause a plaque with scaly borders. Urticaria, erythematous wheals, central clearing, no scale, but of course wouldn't be there for 10 years or more, as this patient says hers was. And subacute cutaneous lupus, an uncommon diagnosis you don't want to miss in primary care, often missed, annular erythematous plaques with central clearing or sometimes central atrophy or scar in the middle, and it can mimic annular psoriasis. And of course, psoriasis can look annular too if the scale is just along the borders. Here's some other diseases, erythema marginatum with rheumatic fever, erythema migrans with Lyme disease. There's this condition called erythema annulare centrifugum, which you might want to have in your brain because it can be associated with hematologic disorders, endocrine disorders, some malignancies, et cetera. So that's our differential of annular skin lesions. I promised you some differential of angular skin lesions. It's not as helpful, but it's not totally useless if you can think of any. So calciphylaxis. Presents calciphylaxis. The description is stellate necrosis, star-like necrosis, because of the angles of the scar, and levamisole vasculopathy. If you're thinking of angular skin lesions, differential diagnosis, and you start thinking about angular keelitis or zoster at the costovertebral angle, then you're just confused about what we're talking about here. And less helpful, perhaps, maybe not helpful at all, is annual skin lesions. I had to think hard about these. There weren't very many. There is an annual frostbite, you know, what kind of annual frostbite could there be? Well, there is the Antarctic winter solstice swim. Here's the Australian Antarctic team dumping in the water in the solstice in sub-freezing temperatures. So that's a form of annual frostbite. There's annual sunburn, you know, occurs on the 4th of July, right? Exactly. There you go. Okay. And then there is an annual perineal erosions eruption. Anyone have any idea when that might be? Annual perineal erosions. No, you're wondering though, well, that's, you know, that's the World Naked Bike Ride, of course. Yeah. So, okay. So any last guesses about what this diagnosis might be, or any guess about who this person is? This person was also worried about a skin lesion. Paul Simon is a guess. You're not too far off. Not too far off. Yeah. So this is Jimmy Buffett, who died last year of Merkel cell cancer of the skin, which is not the diagnosis here, but did have a terrible skin cancer. The diagnosis here is something called porokeratosis. Porokeratosis is what this woman had. And a dermatologist might have been able to figure this out just from the description that the patient gave, which was so crisp and clean about how it was this asymptomatic hyperkeratotic ring that I could feel and that had been there forever. So what to know and why to know about porokeratosis? It's actually kind of an inherited hyperkeratinization disease, and it's misnamed. It has nothing to do with pores at all. We didn't have any winners. I'm sorry about that, but maybe I can convince you that it's worth having in your brain, this disease. This disease, by the way, the diagnosis was made in clinic by doctors who had never heard of it before, but simply Googled the description of the lesion and came up with pictures that were able to make the diagnosis. So maybe that's the lesson of this, is know how to describe your rashes. So this is a disease with multiple annual lesions, raised hyperkeratotic borders. It can be asymptomatic or sometimes itchy. It's often in sun-exposed areas. There's a lot more of this in Australia, but this is a genetic disease with an autosomal dominant inheritance primarily. And it can be precancerous, in fact, about 7% of cases. At least in the literature among dermatologists who are obviously going to see the worst ones, at 7% can become cancers of various kinds, usually squamous cell cancers. This is a form of it called linear porokeratosis. There's a whole bunch of treatments for it. It's, you know, when you see this many treatments for a disease, one thing you know is that they either all work or it's impossible to cure. That's the only two explanations for having this many treatments for a disease. So what are you most interested in? Let's go ahead and take a vote here. I'm going to go ahead and start that. What are you most interested in? Further information about other rare and dangerous skin lesions. Are you interested in whether the neighbor also had porokeratosis? The differential diagnosis of biannual skin lesions. If you have any of those, please let me know because I need cases for next year. The phone number of the guy with the Old Glory sunburn, I have no judgment. And how many people in this room have done the World Naked Bike Ride? Maybe that's what you want to know. And let's see, what are people interested in? I'm sorry, it's just become impossible to display this. I don't quite know why. But a lot of people voted for the World Naked Bike Ride. So maybe we could have a show of hands or a show of whatever you want to show if you've done the World Naked Bike Ride. Oh, okay, no. All right. So there we go. All right. Now I can't get up to there. That is very odd with my clicker. Okay. Yeah, no, I don't quite know what the scoop is. Anyway, that's all right. Well, now it seems to be working okay. We will move on here. I'm sorry we did not have any winners, but we're going to go on to our last case. Perhaps our most convoluted one, but maybe the most fun one. A 74-year-old woman who has refractory oral ulcers, sprue, and a rash. So you're the oncologist in this case, and she's been referred to you because she is particularly concerned that underlying malignancy explains her many months of illness. She complains chiefly of oral ulcers for about 7 months that have not responded to acyclovir, TNF inhibitors, a long taper of steroids, because she had a tentative diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, compliance with a gluten-free diet, despite confusion regarding a diagnosis of sprue, and high doses of vitamins to prevent COVID. So now we're gonna learn a little bit about why she went through all of this and yet is still sick and worried about cancer and her rash. So she's had oral ulcers for about 7 months. She was hospitalized 5 months prior with these ulcers, and she had an SBO at that time that cleared spontaneously. A biopsy of the mouth ulcer at that time showed ulcerated squamous mucosa with lichenoid inflammation. There was no dysplasia or cancer, and direct immunofluorescence was negative. She had an upper and lower endoscopy. All of it was normal, including biopsies. Background, past medical history, asthma, CHF, history of DVT on anticoagulation, gastritis, hypertension, osteoarthritis, sigmoid diverticulitis. She's had some surgeries. These were the medications she's taking: pantoprazol, acetaminophen, apixaban, pregabalin, verapamil, nebula, some inhalers, furosemide, trazodone, and a bunch of topicals for her mouth ulcers that are not working. She doesn't smoke. She has rare alcohol consumption, family medical history of dementia, heart disease, hypertension, and stroke. So you're
You see her and you see a thin woman in no acute distress. She has persistent oral ulcerations, consistent, they kind of look like aphthous ulcers, and there's this new rash on her lower extremities. So you try to figure out what's going on in this case. You go back through and you realize that 2 months prior, she'd seen a rheumatologist. And the rheumatologist noted the ulcers were moderately, were very painful. It was difficult for her to eat and chew. She was getting no relief from topicals. She'd had 20 pounds weight loss, and she was worried about underlying cancer, and she was worried about SPRU. She had no genital ulcers, no rashes at that time. She'd had arthralgias. What's that? Scurvy. Oh my goodness, scurvy. She had arthralgias. She had morning stiffness for less than 30 minutes. She had hair loss, dry eyes, and a dry mouth. Exam findings by the rheumatologist. She had a bunch of ulcers on the buccal mucosa and beneath the lower lip. The rheumatologist noted some tenderness at some PIP joints, some Hebridine's nodes, otherwise unremarkable exam. I do have a picture of the oral ulcers, although it's not the actual patient. Sorry about that, but it's representative in any case. You should be able to see. So let's go ahead and take a vote here. Why do you think the rheumatologist ordered the obligate and expertly tailored deluge of rheumatologic tests that we always see? And what else did the rheumatologist do besides that? They also order an antiviral medication, topical glucocorticoids, a PCR NAT for HSV, SPRU serologies, even though there was a negative small bowel biopsy, and despite the fact that you're a rheumatologist. Did the rheumatologist order a gluten-free diet? Because after all, the patient might be right. That's what the patient's worried about. So let's stop that. Let's see if I can, again, I can't display. So I'm gonna have to tell you the winner here was the PCR NAT for HSV. Some people, but they kind of, the answers are spread all over. That's probably appropriate because in fact, the rheumatologist ordered everything, all of these things here. And once again, I am somehow stuck with my marker. There it goes. A topical allergy, a contact allergy in the mouth or something like that. Okay. If I don't know exactly what you're talking about and I can't repeat it, that's probably not the answer. Yeah, exactly right. So the rheumatologist finds on follow-up that the symptoms were unchanged despite all that valacyclovir. Rheumatologist did some hand x-rays that show some degenerative changes, normal inflammatory markers. There's a negative rheumatoid factor in anti-CCP as well as some HLA tests, but there's a positive 1433 ETA protein. Chest x-ray was unchanged, looking for interstitial lung disease. There was none of that. So at this point, what would you do? Go ahead and start voting. At this point, I think the rheumatologist diagnosed RA, A, because of the stiffness, PIP tenderness, and positive 1433 ETA protein. You think the rheumatologist diagnosed RA tentatively because of the negative anti-CCP and rheumatoid factor and the concern for an alternate diagnosis of SPRU, because if they liked diagnosing SPRU, they would have done a GI fellowship because they were proud that diagnosing RA is what their people do, or they diagnosed RA because they wanted to diagnose something that the patient hadn't already thought of. Let's see what people say. People like A by a long shot here. Clinical diagnosis. The rest of you are cynics, thought number five was really the reason. So let's go on here. We'll hide that. And then, so the rheumatologist said, I'm tentatively diagnosing this patient with rheumatoid arthritis and gave her Depo-Medrol, methylprednisolone, tapered over many weeks, a TNF inhibitor, and continued the valacyclovir just to cover the bases, but didn't give her any methotrexate. Because after all, she already has oral ulcers. So what happens? She's tolerating these medicines on follow-up. The prednisone's down to 4 milligrams. The arthralgias and the PIP tenderness have improved, but the ulcers are unchanged. The patient had begun, this was right in the middle, like 2021 or so, the patient had begun taking high-dose supplements and vitamins, quote, to ward off COVID, and the patient strongly requests a celiac antibody profile and an oncology referral. So what would you do? Let's go ahead and vote here again. What do you think are the two least interesting aspects of this case so far? Sometimes it's helpful to eliminate the things that are not useful for you. So is it the steroid therapy and improving arthralgias, a room consult and a diagnosis of RA? Is it a patient worried about cancer and SPRU at the same time? Is it a negative small bowel biopsy and a patient requesting even more tests for SPRU that you're putting out of your mind? Or is it a negative small bowel biopsy and a doctor ordering more tests for SPRU? Let's see. The answer here is the votes here are for B. A room consult and a diagnosis of RA is even less impressive than arthralgias getting better with steroids. That's saying a lot, my friends. Okay. And then people also thought a patient worried about cancer and SPRU, but the answers are spread out sort of all over the place there. All right. So the plot thickens because annoyingly, some of the tests as the patient insisted she get returned positive. The patient has a normal serum IgA level. And has IgG to anti-TTG and anti-gliadin, but no IgA. So she was started on a gluten-free diet and referred to GI to sort out this question of celiac SPRU. So if the patient goes to the gastroenterologist all before she sees the oncologist, which is you, you should be guessing here, trying to figure out what's going on in this lady. She has the GI notes very tactfully. Thank you for your question about SPRU, but that she'd had a small bowel biopsy that was negative just a few months prior. Notes that the ulcers are not improving, the patient's having difficulty eating and is miserable. Now she's complaining of spontaneous bruising, and she's got spots on her legs. Yeah, she's got a rash. What does the gastroenterologist do? Gastroenterologist orders HLA DQ2 and DQ8 genetic testing, hoping they will be negative to put this question to rest, because these genetic tests are very sensitive for celiac disease, but they're not very specific. Annoyingly, they both return positive. So GI diagnosis SPRU tentatively. And at this point, let's go ahead and vote. At this point, what are you most interested in? What's that? Behçet's disease, okay. Good guessing there. If the mystery diagnosis is SPRU, then why is it in the title? Does this mean I have to listen to all of my patients' suggestions? Are you most interested in which supplement the patient recommends that you take to prevent COVID? Which CPT modifier designates a tentative diagnosis? Or can we just get back to the oncology consult? And sure enough, it's spread over mostly C. Patients want to know about which supplement to prevent COVID. Otherwise, confused about the rest of the case. Some people want to know about how to diagnose a tentative diagnosis. The answer is you can't. You're not allowed to make a tentative diagnosis. So that's, sorry, a little mansplaining there. Toxicity from the COVID supplements. Okay, so go back to her oncology consultation just to review. She's had an SBO, weight loss, bruising, tentative rheumatoid arthritis, celiac confusion, but we're kind of going with it. She's got worsening mouth ulcers for 7 months and that are now oozing blood. And all of this has been refractory to these treatments. And of course, she's developing this rash. What's this? She's folate deficient and taking methotrexate on the side. Okay, that's a long, it could be. I can't put that all on one slide, so it can't be the answer, but I appreciate that. That's the guesses have to do with folate for the people at home. I do have a picture of the leg rash here. Again, this is not the actual patient. I apologize. Bear with me here. This is a clue because number one, this guinea pig has the disease that we're talking about. And number two, the fact that this guinea pig has the disease is actually a clue as the diagnosis. So once again, what's that? That's a great question. No is the answer. All right, here's a picture of the rash again. Let you look at the rash. So at this point, what would you do? Let me go ahead and stop this and restart the voting here. At this point, I would obtain a skin biopsy. I would order Hep B and C antibodies, get a chest x-ray to look for hyaluronopathy. You'd ask the rheumatologist if they were certain that they got all of the vasculitis tests, or would you downgrade your diagnosis of SPRU and RA from tentative to aspirational? Let's see what people voting here. People like the skin biopsy idea. Others would do Hep B and C antibodies. And one person would go back to the rheumatologist to say, hey, maybe you missed something there. A diagnostic test was performed. Go ahead and vote again. What do you think the test was? Was it direct immunofluorescence of the skin? Was it an antibody test that you ordered? Was it a more specific gene test? Was it a test added by the oncologist as an afterthought? Or was it LabCorp's new comprehensive guinea pig rheumatoid celiac panel, which, by the way, you can't actually order in Providence until next week, so it can't be the answer. But let's see, what do people say? People like the idea that this is going to be a skin biopsy. Some people thought it was an afterthought test, and some people want to use LabCorp's guinea pig test, which doesn't actually exist. But you could propose it. It could be a QI project. So any last guesses as to who this is or what the diagnosis is? Shout it out, those at home. I'll try to hear you. What's that? Side effect from a medication. Okay. Yeah, that's a great answer. You'd have to be more specific to win thieves market. Yeah. Overgrowth of yeast in the mouth. Yeah, maybe Candida. Okay. This is Yoko Ono. So a diagnostic test was in fact an afterthought by the oncologist, just as some of you thought in the audience. What's this? Copper deficiency. Okay. Yeah, but it's related to the thing with the zinc in the mouth that you mentioned before. Yeah, different thieves market case. So to ward off COVID, the patient had been taking high doses of vitamins. So the oncologist thought the same thing one of you did. Is she toxic? So vitamin A came back somewhat elevated, slightly. Vitamin D came back kind of above what we call the normal range. By the way, the oncologist decided to throw in a vitamin C level. That was undetectable. Yes, the diagnosis here is scurvy. This patient has developed scurvy. Thank you very much. We have a winner here. We're going to have you come up in just a second. Actually, I might have you do it at the end just for time purposes. I'll get your picture at the end, but thank you, Shelley. So here's scurvy, my friends. Some of you may recognize the authors of this paper, Jim Ruler and Tom Cooney, sort of legendary Oregon internists. So we have a winner, and I promise, Shelley, I'll get your picture. But let's learn a little bit about scurvy first here. In the age of discovery, 1300 to 1800, 2 million sailors are thought to have died of scurvy. That's a lot of people given the population of the world at that time. For example, in the Seventh Crusade, Jean de Joinville recorded that, quote, "the barbers were forced to cut away very large pieces of flesh from the guns to enable their patients to eat." Some of you know the association of scurvy with James Lind, who was a ship surgeon. He was not the first person to see the association between scurvy and citrus, but he was the first person who was thought to have ever done a controlled trial of anything, because he took 12 sailors and put them into 6 groups. And some of them got cider, some of them got vitriolic elixir, some of them got vinegar, some of them got seawater, some of them got a purgative mixture, and the lucky ones got 2 oranges and a lemon. And what happened? We can read right from his words. The consequence was that the most sudden and visible good effects were perceived from the use of the oranges and the lemons, one of those who had taken them being at the end of 6 days fit for duty. The other was the best recovered of any in his condition, and being now deemed pretty well, was appointed nurse to the rest of the sick. So that's our first controlled trial. Here's a picture of the rash of scurvy. You see perifollicular hemorrhages, you see hair loss, and then the nearly pathognomonic corkscrew hairs. But it's not just an old disease. Here's an outbreak of scurvy in a refugee population in Kenya not so long ago. This man has disease in his mouth and got much better with a little vitamin C. And there's modern day scurvy. This is a 37-year-old woman with opiate use disorder, PTSD. She'd resided at a homeless shelter for about 3 months, was skipping meals because of financial insecurity and had a predominant intake of fast foods. In the United States, among poorer populations and those in food deserts, vitamin C levels are very low. This may not surprise you if you look at the top 5 foods that make up 30% of all the fruits and vegetables consumed in the United States. They are iceberg lettuce, tomatoes, French fries, bananas, and orange juice, which is the only one that has any vitamin C in it at all. Scurvy in the aging population. Here's some reports. A 63-year-old woman reported a 1-month history of poor eating, weight loss, and swollen, bleeding gums. She mainly was eating pasta and no freshies. By the way, you can see here that her gums are normal where there are no teeth. This is not primarily a gum disease. This is primarily a tooth disease that it provides an entry into the gums. So no teeth, no gum disease in scurvy. There are a number of pictures that demonstrate that you can find. So what happened to our patient? Where her oral ulcers persisted despite all these treatments that she was getting before this. She was treated with high-dose vitamin C, 2 to 4 grams daily, And after several weeks, her vitamin C level was still undetectable. Finally, the ulcers resolved, but only after we restored her vitamin C, which required IV dosing of 1.5 grams daily. By the way, she was hospitalized a month later for COVID. So no, vitamin C doesn't work for that. You might ask, why did she get oral ulcers? Oral ulcers presented possibly in this case before the dietary restrictions. This woman was so worried about Spru, no one was really sure when she started her dietary restrictions. Spru has many oral manifestations, but typically not these oral ulcers. Oral ulcers are not typical of scurvy either and might have been incidental in this case, but the fact is they've been there for 8 months, refractory to everything, and went away only after her vitamin C level was repleted. That's just the way it is. So why did she get scurvy? Well, it probably was not the Spru. It might have had something to do with the diet and ulcers. And then RA and steroids, is that even possible? I'm just going to not go through details, but when I did a search to try to put all the parts of this case together, I got these intriguing reports about vitamin C deficiency associated with rheumatoid arthritis and or critical illness with the use of steroids or both. That makes me think there's a connection there that no one has quite put together. Here was our clue, by the way. Very few animals in the world can get scurvy, but guinea pigs are one of them. They can get it after 15 days. They get very sick, lose stools. Death can occur in just a few weeks. I have a minute just to try to play this, if it will play. Maybe it's not going to do that. Oh, well, it's too bad. It's a heartbreaking video. You'll have to trust me here. Of a guinea pig dying of scurvy because it was ignored. So last question here, let's go ahead and take a vote. Please vote on here. I do wanna know, I wish I were a guinea pig doctor because my patients would almost never do internet searches, would almost never be vaccine hesitant, would almost never diagnose Spru before I do, would almost never demand a letter supporting the need for an emotional support human, or would almost never complain that they don't wanna be treated like a guinea pig. And you'll have to believe me, the votes are all over the place with a high majority of voting for E, that patients wouldn't complain about the guinea pig. But the not doing internet searches is kind of a close second there. So thank you very much. I just want to say we're at time here. I apologize. Thank you for your participation, for your love of medicine. If you have a case, please contact me. If you think it would work, we'll help. You can become famous. And there we are. Thank you very much. Shelley, come up for your picture. We had two winners.
Okay, I can I tell you about
$1 million. And then I need your picture. Wait.